This is Charlie Seavey, your host and wandering reporter. What we have here is a series of interviews done at the 2006 conference of the Association for Library and Information Science Education, also known as ELISE, held in San Antonio in mid-January. This is not live, so none of the usual phone numbers or email addresses will work. This isn't a detailed report. Read American Libraries or Library Journal for that. What we have here is interviews, live and on the iPod, with folks I find interesting or I thought might have something interesting to say. There are some of the usual suspects and some surprises. So sit back, play an old Jerry Jeff Walker tune in the back of your mind, and listen to the sounds of ELISE.
And we're here at the ELISE First Timers Breakfast, and you can hear the hubbub in the background as people are eating eggs and drinking coffee and all those breakfasty kind of things. And I'm interviewing newcomers to ELISE, and I have here a person who is simultaneously a newcomer and a brand new dean of an LIS school. So I'm talking with Susan Roman, who recently became head of Dominican University. And of course, the obvious question is, how do you wind up being a first comer and a dean simultaneously?
I guess I just got lucky. Well, this is, I've only been in the position a few months, and I'm pretty excited about it. Actually, we're taking off a new direction. And one of those new directions was looking for some exciting new faculty. And this is the place to be, to meet people, potential faculty members, meet colleagues. So I'm pretty excited about it.
You're actually interviewing one of my doctoral students later on, somewhere along, Lisa Hussey. So, yeah, she's good folks. She worked for me in Arizona. She was our program director for a while I was acting director down there. So I've been in the head seat. I didn't have much fun. I wish you much more fun than I had running a school.
Well, it's so new to me, and I think, you know, because it's an exciting time at the school. The program has just set a new strategic plan. We're pretty excited, and our tagline is educating library leaders, because we know it's going to take more. Many of our graduates will be going into libraries that within a year they're going to wind up maybe head of a branch, head of a library. And then with a lot of the retirees will be a lot of the leadership. So we feel we really need to move in that direction. So we're pretty excited.
Good. I'm glad to hear it, and we'll see how it goes in the next few years. I'll be checking in with you at Seattle. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm here with Joyce Valenza, who's a doctoral student at North Texas University, which is not all that far from San Antonio, which probably explains why there's a huge number of North Texas students here. So you've just told me you're part of the distributed learning program. Do you want to explain that to me?
Yeah, it started 2 years ago as part of an IMLS grant to meet the needs of universities for which there was kind of a dearth of doctoral students, people teaching in the areas of both public and school libraries. Our cohort has met about 8 times for intensive long weekend face-to-face sessions, and the courses are continued online. Our research is shared online. Basically, it's kind of a blended or a hybrid experience of face-to-face and online learning.
So where do you actually, you're not in residence in Denton then, you're off in the boondocks somewhere. There's lots of boondocks in Texas.
Yeah, I'm in the boondocks of Philadelphia most days. And then I go to lovely downtown Denton.
Well, that's one heck of a commute. But really, Philadelphia to Denton, there wasn't any doctoral program around in Philadelphia that would do it for you.
I was looking at a number of other doctoral programs, but when this one came around, I was just about ready to look locally. But this was a grant, and so it's a full scholarship, and it's hard to say no to free.
Yeah, money makes a big difference. I know from my doctoral student time many, many, many years ago. Well, Joyce, I hope we see you at these conferences more. I'll be checking in with you again in Seattle, and I trust you'll be there.
I'll be there, sure.
It's break time here at the ELISE conference, and we're here with Norman Horrocks, who is the writing the conference up for a library journal. Norman's also a past dean at Dalhousie, past president of ALA, past president of ALIS, past virtually everything, and one of the few guys that's been around longer than I have. So you've been observing this conference for a long time. What do you think about this year's meeting thus far?
Thus far, it seems good. I think the idea of having the post-assessments for the doctoral students last night was a great innovation. And they're keeping, they're having other post-assessments tonight and Wednesday, so I think that's a real plus.
What do you think about the attendance, which looks to me to be considerably up from years past?
Well, the nature of the conference has changed in that it's now a recruiting agency.
Yeah.
And that brings a lot of faculty members, actual and potential, to the conference, which is good. On the other hand, the people are interviewing instead of going to the session, so, you know.
Yeah, there's been some conversation that it's turned into a horrible meat market, but on the other hand, you know, more people is more jobs is good for LIS education.
True, and ACES is trying to ace it out in that ACES soon means in November, and they try and get the first crack, and so they're now developing their, as you so nicely put it, meat market.
Well, that's kind of a crude term, but I hear the doctoral students using, well, in fact, I used it when I was a doctoral student, but, well, we'll see how it all goes.
The other change, I think, is the, ALIS, or ALS as it was, the Associated American Library School, is the strength now of the non-accredited programs, or the not-yet-accredited programs, or the, at one time, as you know, it was a closed shop, and that if your program was not accredited, you couldn't be a full participating member in this association. That's all changed now, and I think for the better.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of my doctoral students has an interview with Penn State, which 10 years ago wasn't even a player in this, and is not accredited, but clearly in our line of the business.
Correct, and there are other programs. The schools, like I was talking to Wally Kohler from Valdosta, they're gearing up for accreditation. Before that, I was talking 2 minutes ago to the University of Ottawa, University Librarian. They are planning to reopen their school. They closed it in 75, and they're planning to reopen it. They're here testing the waters, meeting with other Canadian schools. So there's a little ferment, which is good to see.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, some expansion in the field is good. We lost a lot of schools over a 20-30-year period, and now people are coming back on board. Denver got reaccredited a while back. Valdosta's got this slightly different model. Penn State's clearly moving into things. I mean, and this is good news about Ottawa, too, because it was Sam Rothstein once wrote an article about the Canadian library schools, and you really needed more of them, as I recall it.
That's right, and another thing about Sam to remember, he is the longest-serving past president of this association.
Sam is still with us, I take it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still at UBC, at the University of British Columbia, and I'm the new director of UBC School. Well, 2 years now is Edie Rusness and she's here, but yeah, Sam's still going strong.
The greatest interview I had as a doc student was with UBC, and Sam was involved, and I won't tell the whole story, but a bottle of scotch was involved as well.
Well, my first interview in the States was, I was very young and naive, and I came from, I'd come from Britain and Australia to the States. And I met Neil Harlow, who was the dean at Rutgers, who said to me at this conference many years ago, "Have you ever come to New York City?" And I said, "Oh, yes. I have a good friend, Eric Moon, editor of the Library Journal. I'm coming over to see him in a month." He said, "Well, why don't you drop in and see us?" I did. He was very nice, hospitable. He said, "Well, let me take you around and meet the various faculty members." I met them all. And then he said, "Well, I'll be back in a minute, Norman." And then he came and said, "Well, it's unanimous. We want to make you an offer." I said, "Well, that's what you came for, isn't it?" I didn't know that in those days before affirmative action and so on, that was the way hiring was done. It literally was the old boy network. and that was my first experience of being on the receiving end of it.
So you didn't even know you were being interviewed and wound up with a job offer. Oh, would that we could still do that in some ways.
The other thing that I think has got to be of interest in this association is the change of the makeup of the schools and the little group of so-called high schools. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, there's definitely some tension in the air on that particular topic, which I don't think I'm going to pursue anymore at this stage of the game.
No, and I'll be interested to see how it all plays out.
Oh, yeah, we all will.
And at one time we had the school library program, the school media programs, and they were also something on the outer. So it's just a different approach, I think.
Oh, yeah, times change, and we have to change with them. So, folks, we're here with Norman Horrocks at the Elise Conference. Norman, I want to thank you. We've known each other for a good number of years now, and I have one more of these left, so maybe we'll talk again next year.
All right, and then you can get the introduction correct. I was never president of the American Library Association.
You were.
No, I ran twice. I got creamed the first time because I was a Canadian running against a man against a woman, and the woman was the Deputy Librarian of Congress, so that was no contest. So the following year I ran by petition and lost by about 300 votes, so that was it.
Well, I'll get my history straight next year. Norman, thank you again. We're here with Dick Kawuya, who's a doctoral student at the University of Tennessee. Dick's a native Ugandan, and he's doing his doctoral research on a really kind of interesting area that's just starting to form up, the interaction of African communal ideas of communal use of music, traditional music, which is just starting to bump up against Western ideas of intellectual property and ownership. And you're just back from Uganda, as I understand it.
Yes, I came back 2 weeks ago, and I was conducting field work, speaking to traditional musicians, folk musicians, and basically exploring the issue of ownership, their understanding or construction of ownership.
Which is a long way from the Western notion of ownership, as I understand what you've been telling me here.
Right. It's certainly different. Of course, the interaction with Western views is kind of changing. That's what I was able to establish from my field work. But originally it's been a collectivist, communal approach. So that concepts like ownership, individual private ownership, were not known at a given point. So some of these concepts are coming up simply because these individuals are interacting with Western views on issues of corporate and property ownership. Yeah. Right.
Is there a difference now in this country? There would be, and in most Western countries, there'd be a difference between what's seen as really traditional music. It's been around for 100 years and whatnot. Nobody really owns it. But then you have new music or newer music that's created by a singer or a songwriter or a band is ownership of that is a very clear concept in the Western tradition. Now, there's traditional African music, what I would imagine in this country would be regarded as copyright-free, but how about the stuff that people are, the music that people are creating right now that's by an individual singer or a band? Is there that notion of intellectual ownership exist in that context?
The distinction is not exactly clear at this point. I mean, the attempt to define what traditional cultural music is. For instance, there is oftentimes talk of traditional instruments which follow certain music, which is used for certain music, as a way of defining what traditional music is. But in terms of African context, or Uganda for that matter, you find that there are musicians that you'd call mainstream contemporary musicians that borrow from the traditional music. So there's a back and forth movement between what you'd call traditional on one hand and contemporary on the other. So it's, the line dividing these two groups is really blurred at this point.
This is going to be really interesting, and listening to Dick talk about his research for the last half hour or so, I keep thinking of a dissertation defense that involves a boombox and a dissertation that has a CD in the back of it with the music to demonstrate where you're going with all this. Do you think that's a possibility? Or?
Yeah, I'm actually thinking of an electronic thesis, an electronic dissertation, where I can insert clips of musical recordings which I was able to capture to the extent that, those clips don't identify certain groups, because the idea is that the information I got is confidential. So, but to the extent that I can use those clips to elaborate what I'm trying to explain in my work, I'll do that.
This is really interesting stuff. We've been with Dick Coyo, who's a doctoral student at Tennessee, and I look forward to the dissertation defense. Thanks so much, Dick.
Thank you.
And here we are. It's Tuesday night at the Elise program, and one of the interesting things about Elise is always the doctoral student poster session, where the young doctoral students gather up with their posters, hoping well beyond hope that some faculty will notice them and perhaps hire them into gainful employment and a teaching career. And I'm here with Kim Thompson, who's a doctoral student at Florida State, and she's going to tell me what her poster is all about, which doesn't have any fancy pictures on it, I must add. This is, it's kind of plain looking. I assume there's a lot of information there, so to make up for it.
Yes, yes. The title is Framing an Information Society, and it's plain intentionally. Since about the 1960s, we've been calling the United States an information society, and with all the razzle-dazzle of technology, I thought that it would be a good idea to go back to the Constitution and see if maybe information were a part of the framing of the United States, and in fact it is. And I have here a small chart with the articles of the Constitution that specifically mention information, which was unheard of at that time in history. And so it's pared down because, regardless of the technologies, just print and paper, ink and paper, is what began our information.
You're saying there are limitations to print and paper?
Pardon me?
There are limitations to print and paper?
I would say no. I would say there are no limitations to print and paper. And so it stands strong even today in 2006.
Yeah. Good. You're a smart doctoral student, I can tell.
Oh, thank you very much.
Did you get in? I think we've had this conversation before, but did you get into the Federalist Papers at all? Because there are several references in there basically to public information and the need therefore.
I do not have that right now. I only have the Constitution on this. I'm just giving a very, very brief framework since it's a poster and minimal information, but I will look into that as well.
Somewhere I've got a paper with some references, and I'll try and remember to send it to you. So tell me, what are your job prospects here anyway? Have you been employed, or are you still a starving student?
Actually, a few weeks ago, I electronically signed an agreement to work for the University of Missouri at Columbia.
Oh, why, son of a gun. Nobody told me that, but what a pleasant surprise. We're certainly glad to have you on the faculty and looking forward to you getting there later this year.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it, too.
Obviously, a put-up job, folks. I couldn't resist this, and Kim's got a good sense of humor about the whole thing. Kim Thompson, thanks for filling us in. And we'll see you in a couple of 3 months here.
Sounds good.
Okay, folks, we're still at the doctoral student poster session, but I'm here with Leslie Weir, who's university librarian at the University of Ottawa in Canada, that large cold place up north. And it seems that they're actually going to start a library school up there, and Leslie is the main fire plug getting the thing going. Is that true, or am I making things up here?
Oh, that's very true, Charlie. I'm the champion of this newest library school that we're hoping to have open. We're planning for classes to start in September 07, and looking for approval from our Senate in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Super. Now, this is, you used the word library, so I'm assuming we're not talking about some information school, are we, in disguise?
I'm afraid the I word does float around quite a bit. We are looking at a library information management, information policy, archives program.
This is going to cost a lot of Canadian dollars. Who's funding all this?
Well, we have a...
Or don't you want to tell me?
Oh, no, we've got a fabulous situation in the province I live right now, in Ontario. The provincial government is going to invest hundreds of millions of in expanding graduate school study programs. So, in fact, I'm just riding on that coattail. The timing is right.
Well, life could be sweet when you've got a deal like that. Now, wasn't there a long time ago, wasn't there a library school there, or is that in the dim recesses of my memory?
Oh, you're so right. There was a library school for about 50 years, and it closed in 1972. It was never accredited, though, by the ALA, and it was, in fact, a bachelor program.
Okay, well, there were a number of bachelor programs floating around for a long time. I think there was, even into the 80s, there might have been at least one or two bachelor programs floating around. But, yeah, the 70s were a hard time for any kind of library school at that stage of the game. But so this is really interesting. And how many faculty are you looking forward to having?
We're looking at 8 tenure-track positions, plus, of course, adjuncts that will play a very key role. We actually have a large employer advisory committee that includes all of the large libraries in the region, and they're going to be an integral part of the planning for our school.
See, I'm thinking, I wonder if I could trade on my mother's Canadian citizenship and apply for a job here, or is that out of the question?
Est-ce que vous parlez français?
No. Non.
I will say the University of Ottawa is actually one of the few bilingual universities in North America, and so our programs are offered in English and French. So it's a minor challenge in terms of our recruitment of faculty.
I think it's going to be a big-time challenge. I remember Sam Rothstein at UBC many, many years ago wrote a piece about shortage of Canadian PhDs in LIS. How are you going to get around this and the bilingual aspect of it?
Well, it is a challenge. It's interesting you bring that up because I'm actually the vice president, president-elect of the Canadian Association of Research Libraries. And we're actually hoping to meet with the deans and directors of library schools in Canada and look at how we can work together to improve the marketing of our profession, but also help build up the number of people who go to study PhD, because it is a challenge.
Yeah, we've got, I'm sure you're aware, in the U.S., much the same situation where we've got all kinds of doctoral students, but very, very few of them have ever been anywhere near a library or understand, in fact, what one is.
Oh, you picked one of my pets, you devil. I have been heard to say that I would never hire someone with a PhD in library and information science if they had never worked in a library. In fact, I don't think that doctoral students should be able to enter the program without at least having done some kind of a stage or some kind of a period working. We have an interesting profession. It has the whole academic side and research, but it does also have the practical side. And I really think you need to marry the two and have the benefits of both.
Yeah, I think largely I agree with you. I think we're going to have to maybe do a little fudging on it just because getting librarians is so tough. We've got a doc student right now who has got a fair amount of paraprofessional time but hasn't put any time in with her MLS. On the other hand, we've got a master's student who's really, really smart, and we're telling her, go out and work a couple of years and then come back and talk to us about a doctorate. So I think there are probably a lot of judgment calls involved in this one.
Yeah, I think actually the experience as a paraprofessional or even as a non-professional in the library world is equally valuable, just with different aspects. I myself began my career as head of circulation at a small public library in Montreal. In fact, I like to promote myself as a crossover artist, because I have, in fact, worked in special libraries, in public libraries, in government libraries, and academic libraries, and I've worked in acquisitions, cataloging, systems, reference, collections, electronic resources, and management.
Well, that just beats my career all the snot.
I haven't taught in a library school, except as a guest lecturer.
Yeah, that's okay. No, I spent time as a real librarian for about 8 years before I went off to doctoral work, so I certainly appreciate the impulse there.
Well, sounds like you had an excellent career path.
I think I did. Well, folks, we've been here with Leslie Weir, University of Ottawa librarian and a budding new library school dean. It'll be interesting to see how this comes out.
Well, thank you very much. We'll keep you informed.
I'm sure you will.
Wednesday night, and we're still headed for the last roundup here. In fact, this is the last roundup of the day. I'm here with Ken Haycock, who's dean at San Jose State University in California and became a few hours ago the past president of ELISE. And, Ken, I'm wondering, how does it feel to be the past president?
Well, we had a wonderful year. It was a transitional year where we managed to increase the membership. We managed to increase the revenue. We had a very successful conference that focused on the scholarship of teaching and learning. So in one sense, it's a great relief to be a past president. On the other hand, there's a great deal more to be done. And so you feel a little bit like you'd like to continue to shepherd things along, but you've really just got to get out of the way and let people continue in their own way. So I think there's a great possibility for this organization. And we've had a wonderful year and a great foundation, seemingly.
Yeah, of course, the past president gets to sit on the board for a whole other year, so you're not quite out of the spotlight yet.
Well, while I was president, we actually structured a role for the past president, which I think will make things much easier. The past president becomes the chair of the governance committee, and the governance committee is responsible for resolution and bylaws, but we've also added a charge that the governance committee is to look at ways that the board can evaluate itself, can continue to improve, can become aware of best practice in effective board governance, and find ways to measure its success.
It's quite clear, and as everybody that's been in ELISE for a long time knows, you and your immediate predecessors sort of had to rebuild us out of the rubble, so to speak. And let me say from my side of the microphone, that was a great accomplishment, because I really had my doubts for a while.
Well, I think there were different strengths that happily coincided with the association's needs. Elizabeth Aversa took some hard decisions with her board and to change the management firm. I found a management firm that fit more with ELISE values and needs at that time. Louise Robbins had a different set of skills, and she came in and found ways to start the organization moving in a positive direction, building on that foundation. Through an unfortunate set of events, Louise actually was president for 2 years, and in many ways that was a very good thing, because it allowed that transitional time to be of an appropriate length for her to do the things that need to be doing, and it allowed me to come in and work with her for a year to develop a strategic plan for the association, and then as president a year to see that it was implemented.
Yeah, and something to be said for continuity in that situation. What's your hope for the future, aside from putting your feet up for a little while, now that you don't have to do strategic plans?
Well, my hope for ELISE is that it continues to focus on what I think is its unique niche, and that's focusing on research and the scholarship of teaching and learning, because it is an association of educators. I think there are other places where people can discuss their research in content and disciplinary areas. So my hope is that we continue to focus in that area. We get more sophisticated about providing support for faculty and part-time faculty and becoming more effective instructors and teachers for our students. And of course, I just started at San Jose State University 4 months ago, so I feel like I've got some attention to give there as well.
Yeah. Sunny California, folks. Think about it. Ken, I want to thank you for being with us, and that's it for the evening.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again. We're into the last day of the conference, in fact, the last hour of the conference, as it happens, and I'm here with Jim Carmichael, who is a longtime pal and a warrior in the library history wars, and Jim's done a lot of library history, but he prefers the term raconteur, I think, and he's saying yeah. So, Jim, what do you think about the current state of library history? Where are we and where are we going?
we always have a long way to go. We always have a long way to go. I could say it was a lot better than it was when I started, and when people would kind of back away into a corner when I told them what my specialty was, and they would say, "That's nice." I would say, to judge from the publications, a lot better.
So when were actually you starting in on library history? I think you and I are both from the same time.
Got my degree in 88, but I started thinking that if I got a degree, it would have to be in something practical, like bibliographic instruction. And didn't we need another dissertation in bibliographic instruction? And my first seminar with Ed Holly, with 119 footnotes on my paper, convinced me that possibly we did not need still more history on the history of bibliographic instruction / library use instruction / information literacy / whatever it's called this week. But I finally decided that I was getting older, and I thought I would have some fun. And I thought, I didn't really think, people have told me since I did that, why, this is nothing but gossip. And I said, no, it's history. And now I've decided that maybe there is such a thing as a PhD in library gossip. Since gossip is what runs institutions, it runs our government in Washington, it runs universities, it makes the wheels spin. A good introduction to that subject is the book Moo by Jane Smiley, which is an illustration of the good and the evil that gossip can do.
We actually were talking about Moo about 2 days ago. Somebody uses it in their management course as an example of administration and the way things happen in large academic institutions. So this is an interesting take. As it happens, I think Moo is a fabulous piece of history and gossip.
And my academic library classes, I sit wasting my time at this conference and spending the taxpayers' money in frivolous talk, is absolutely, their text is Moo, along with John Budd's newest edition of his academic library text.
When you think about it, really, I had a hard time convincing my major professor that he always used to say that history always struck him as anecdote was evidence, and yet libraries are such social institutions. It's all about human beings in the end, you know, and how they interact and how they interact with our institution, and, you know, in a way, gossip might be as good a word as any to describe the whole thing.
Yes, and especially since now it is okay not to be in love with the term objectivity, which we know is not a concrete thing now. Albert Einstein knew this years ago. But, of course, in the softer professions, we're insecure and we feel we need numbers to bolster our credibility. But I think there's a nice mix between objectivity and documents and things that we think are facts and official versions of stories. I shudder to think what future historians will make of the newspaper accounts from this week.
Yeah, objectivity. Reality is a social construct in any given era and time, and it's, you know, who knows what's going on there. Well, there you have it, folks. We're going to wrap it up for this whole conference and everything, ending on a high note with Jim Carmichael, who I haven't seen for way too many years.
Wonderful to see you, and it's great to be here. And the best part of this conference is in the hall.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All conferences are like that, and I trust I'll see you again next year in the halls in Seattle when we can do another interview.
I'll sell the family silver.
Thanks so much, Jim. Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
And that is the conference that was. Next year, Elise will be in Seattle. Good coffee guaranteed, and another interesting time to be had by all.
We'll be there with a trusty iPod and a new microphone for a new set of interviews. And that's all from the beautiful Verizon Room in the basement of Townsend Hall on the beautiful campus of the University of Missouri. This has been Charlie Seavey, your interviewer and host. Post-production by Jennifer Crispin and Clayton Kreisel, the faithful techno geeks who do the serious work here at LIS Radio.